The Old Testament, first book of Samuel, chapter 14, and at verse 24. First Samuel 14, 24. Now the men of Israel were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, "Cursed be any man who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies." So none of the troops tasted food. Can you imagine it? The entire army entered the woods, and there was honey on the ground. When they went into the woods, they saw the honey oozing out, yet no one put his hand to his mouth because they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath, so he reached out the end of the staff that was in his hand and dipped it into the honey. He raised his hand to his mouth and his eyes brightened. Then one of the soldiers told him, "Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, 'Cursed be any man who eats food today.' That is why the men are faint." Jonathan said, "My father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey. How much better it would have been if the men had eaten today some of the plunder they took from their enemies. Would not the slaughter of the Philistines have been even greater?" That day, after the Israelites had struck down the Philistines from Michmash to Aijalon, the other side of the ridge, they were exhausted. They pounced on the plunder, and taking sheep, cattle, and calves, they butchered them on the ground and ate them together with the blood. Then someone said to Saul, "Look, the men are sinning against the Lord by eating meat that has blooded it." "You have broken faith," he said. "Roll a large stone over here at once." Then he said, "Go out among the men and tell them, 'Each of you bring me your cattle and sheep and slaughter them here and eat them.'" Pouring out the blood, of course. "Do not sin against the Lord by eating meat with blood still in it." So everyone brought his ox that night and slaughtered it there. Then Saul built an altar to the Lord. It was the first time he had done this. Saul said, "Let us go down after the Philistines by night and plunder them till dawn, and let us not leave one of them alive." "Do whatever seems best to you," they replied. But the priest said, "Let us inquire of God here." So Saul asked God, "Shall I go down after the Philistines? Will you give them into Israel's hand?" But God did not answer him that day. Saul therefore said, "Come here, all of you who are leaders of the army, and let us find out what sin has been committed today. As surely as the Lord who rescues Israel lives, even if it lies with my son Jonathan, he must die." But not one of the men said a word. Saul then said to all the Israelites, "You stand over there. I and Jonathan, my son, will stand over here." "Do what seems best to you," the men replied. Then Saul prayed to the Lord, the God of Israel, "Give me the right answer." And Jonathan and Saul were taken by lot, and the men were cleared. Saul said, "Cast the lot between me and Jonathan, my son. And Jonathan was taken. Then Saul said to Jonathan, tell me what you have done. So Jonathan told him, I merely tasted a little honey with the end of my staff, and now I must die? Saul said, may God deal with me, be it ever so severely, if you do not die, Jonathan. But the men said to Saul, should Jonathan die, he who has brought about this great deliverance in Israel? Never. As surely as the Lord lives, not a hair of his head shall fall to the ground, for he did this today with God's help. So the men rescued Jonathan, and he was not put to death. Then Saul stopped pursuing the Philistines, and they withdrew to their own land. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side. This is a condensed account of the rest of Saul's long reign, which is interesting. You don't find this material anywhere else. After Saul had assumed rule over Israel, he fought against their enemies on every side. Moab, the Ammonites, Edom, the kings of Zobah, and the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he inflicted punishment on them. He fought valiantly and defeated the Amalekites, delivering Israel from the hands of those who had plundered them. Saul's sons were Jonathan, Ishvi, and Malchishua. The name of his older daughter was Merab, and that of the younger was Michal. His wife's name was Ahinoam, daughter of Ahimaaz. The name of the commander of Saul's army was Abner, son of Ner, and Ner was Saul's uncle. Saul's father, Kish, and Abner's father, Ner, were sons of Abiel. All the days of Saul there was bitter war with the Philistines, and whenever Saul saw a mighty or brave man, he took him into his service. Amen. All right then, let's look at these two chapters. As to the years of Saul's reign, numbers in the Old Testament are notably difficult. Acts 13:21 says he reigned for 40 years. But we are much more interested in the character than in the length of Saul's reign. And these two chapters tell us about that. The first act of Saul as king was to select a standing army of two divisions under himself and one under his son Jonathan. He wanted trained crack troops, not a dad's army, and so he sent home the rest. We see, therefore, Saul's preoccupation with these pestiferous Philistines. But this was, of course, in accordance with the terms of his commission from Samuel, as we read of it in 9:16. His commission was to deliver my people from the hands of the Philistines. There was even a Philistine outpost at Saul's hometown of Gibeah, which was a cheek, wasn't it? You read of that in 10:5. Fancy, an outpost of the Philistines at his own home. And there's a word in 12:9 about the fact that because Israel had forgot the Lord their God, the Philistines, as well as Sisera and the king of Moab were breathing down their necks. And the interesting thing is that Samuel, having delivered himself of what he thought was his retirement speech in chapter 12, now leaves Saul to get on with the kingship, which he does apparently without much reference to the Lord, despite the fact that it was by neglect of the Lord that their present troubles arose. And you see, this is exactly the situation with our country, isn't it? God doesn't come into the reckoning of our leaders. And so they go ahead and muddle through. It's interesting to hear Roy Hattersley on retiring from politics after something like 30 years trying to find some justification for his career in politics, and finding very little, except to say that he had helped to keep the Labour Party from falling apart, and now seems keener to write than he ever was to be a politician. Well, and look at all the has-beens sitting comfortably on the benches of the House of Lords. What do they think of themselves? And one or two, like Heath, who clings on to the Commons. Where are we now after all these men have had their say? They don't even want morals to come into basics. What hope is there then of religion, the source of morals? Practically none. Saul's situation was exacerbated by his son Jonathan gaining a tactical victory over the Philistines and raising their ire and their troops, a very great number, so that now this huge army of Philistines was threatening Saul's three divisions of crack troops. But they had fled with Saul down to Gilgal, there to wait 7 whole days for Samuel to come and sacrifice. Whether these were the same 7 days as we read of in chapter 10, verse 8, we know not. Saul impatiently waited 7 days, his troops in the meantime being terrified by the threat of the Philistines' huge army. And with no sign of Samuel on the 7th day, at what time of day do you suppose might he have expected Samuel to appear? Obviously, he didn't wait until sundown. And since he considered the prophet should have appeared early enough in the day to have time to sacrifice before battle, he concluded that he wasn't coming, and so he undertook the sacrifice himself. Well, you remember what happened much later on to King Uzziah, when he intruded into the priest's office and dared to wave a censer in the temple. He was immediately struck with leprosy and remained a leper, living in a separate house, king though he was, until he died. And it was just to be as bad for Saul, for Samuel arrived just as the sacrifice was completed. And can you imagine the consternation and the crisis that arose? Saul, the gormless, obviously thought he had done nothing wrong and went out to greet Samuel. Could you think of anything less sensitive than Saul doing that? The silly ass. And Samuel said to him, "What have you done?" "Well," he said, "I felt I had to sacrifice before the battle." Can you credit the ineptitude of the man in those circumstances? What did it show? A total lack of spiritual savvy. Savoir-vivre. This man's religion was nothing less than a professional farce, which is not unknown. He had no more idea of living, of the living God, than of flying in the air. But you may say, what about his charismatic gift that we read of earlier? And about him being changed into another man? That can all take place, does take place, and yet a man be a silly ass as far as the living God is concerned. The Lord is not an Ouija board to be tapped, like a phone number, to get the right combination. And the safe opens. Voila! What do they think God is? A machine to be trundled around? Hadn't Israel learned enough about the Ark of the Covenant that it was no talisman against wicked folly? No. They hadn't learned. But God has his rules, and he has set them forth, and we'd better take stock of them. Today, this is why the church is in such decline, our denomination at any rate. I spent nearly 2 hours recently listening to ecclesiastical chit-chat by able people about something as elementary as how to start a presbytery meeting. And I knew then, if I never knew before, why the church cuts so little ice. Here's another man being quinquennially visited by presbytery representatives, and he expresses deep concern at his inability to attract the young. This, he says in defense, is an aging congregation, as if that weren't obvious. So, he is strongly urged by those visiting the congregation. What do you think? What do you think when there's need of young people? He's strongly urged to consider a stewardship campaign. Money. Marvelous. That will do the trick, won't it? Calculated to have youngsters crowding his church within weeks. I don't think. Samuel was thunderstruck. You fool, he said. And a fool, you know, in terms of the book of Proverbs. But a knave. Nabal was a fool. In fact, his name means fool. And he of all men, was a cynical monster, wasn't he? But you see, the trouble with Saul was that whether it was his height that gave him airs, or whatever it was, he was absolutely full of his own importance. And he gave a fool account to the enraged Samuel of what he had done about the sacrifice, with complete assurance. All right, said Samuel, when he had cooled down sufficiently to speak. That's you finished as king. Yes, you're finished. You're not fit, man. God has set you aside. He was seeking a man after his own heart, a man who would lean hard on him and learn from him and see things happen for the good of the people and for the denouement, the destruction of these horrid Philistines. And all you can do, Saul, is play around with a bit of perfunctory religion. No chance, Saul. You are dismissed. Not that it's easy to dismiss a disgraced executive, as we know. But God had spoken through the prophet, and that was it. So Samuel went home, and Saul counted his men, not 2,000 or 3,000, but only 600, in face of this tremendous threat of the Philistines. But not only were they short of men. Well, Saul had earlier dismissed a great many men, and others had fled. But the Philistines were far better equipped as an army, so much so that the Israelite warriors had to go down to the Philistine blacksmiths to attend to their agricultural implements, not apparently to make swords for them at all. Well, you could hardly imagine the Israelites going down to the Philistine blacksmiths and saying, "Will you beat out a sword for me to fight against your soldiers?" That would be crazy. And what do you think? The first mention of the Lord's name by anyone other than Saul is in those two chapters. The first mention is by whom do you think? Jonathan. Jonathan to the rescue. And the 14th chapter tells the heroic tale of how Jonathan and his armor bearer climbed up the gorge of Michmash and killed 20 Philistines, so that the rest of that army took panic, thinking a whole battalion was coming against them, and so they fled. It's exciting, isn't it? How did that happen? Because young Jonathan, in seeking desperately to do something for his people's cause against the Philistines, and having lost all faith in his father, actually mentioned the name of the Lord. And God helped him. And it is, you see, as if he had said to his father, "God, Father Saul, God, have you ever heard of him? He could help you if you called on him." We want to say that to some of our leaders today. God, John Major. Have you heard of him? Boris Yeltsin? William Clinton? Have you really heard of him? Do you have any truck with him? There's a God in heaven who orders the affairs of men. Did you know that, you leaders of men? He orders the affairs of man, whether they know it or not. Did you know that? We would ask. And if you did, had it occurred to you how he works? Some of you don't like this. Obviously. I say obviously. He works by prayer. Prayer is the Christian's vital breath, the Christian's native air. Prayer is the motion of a hidden fire that trembles in the breast. You see, Jonathan's ploy is such an exciting story. Don't you think? I'm going to read a little of it again. I find it so exciting. "Do all you have in mind," his armor bearer said. "Go ahead. I am with you heart and soul. And Jonathan said, come then, we will cross over toward the men and let them see us. If they say to us, wait there until we come to you, we will stay where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, come up to us, we will climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands. So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. Look, said the Philistines, the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they have been hiding in. And the men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, come up to us and we'll teach you something. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, climb up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up using his hands and feet with his armor bearer right behind him. And the Philistines fell before Jonathan, and his armor bearer followed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in an area of about half an acre. Then panic struck the whole army, those in the camp and field, and those in the outposts and raiding parties. And the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. Wonderful. Wonderful. Yes. What next? Och, there's that Saul again at his home in Gibeah, looking on. Away, man, don't you know you're dismissed? Not he. He says, someone's been stirring up these Philistines. Who is it? Not that son of mine, Jonathan. I do declare. Who gave him permission to engage the Philistines while Saul was busy with his religious rituals? But you see, the commotion was so great, it forced Saul's hand, because even some deserter Hebrews who had gone over to the Philistines, shades of David later, first Samuel 27, when he went over to the Philistines, the rascal. Some of these deserters later had returned to Israel when they saw how the mad rush had gone, and the Philistines were routed. And so, by the prayerful initiative of Jonathan and his armor-bearer, there was the most almighty rout that day you could, or perhaps couldn't imagine. A wonderful victory, and all due to the prayer of Jonathan. But Saul was already mentally sick, having forced himself, as he said, to sacrifice in the absence of Samuel. He seems to have got hold of a religious bug, and he's playing the super spiritual with all his might. Ahijah the priest is his right-hand man, with the ark, of course. Hadn't they had enough of carting that around? No. And then this. Saul commanded a great fast for his remnant of his army until the enemy was routed. It was the maddest thing imaginable. If they had to go to war, that day, it would have to be on empty stomachs. Well, that's what Paul ordered. Saul ordered. So Saul's men were apparently hiding, trembling in the woods, and Jonathan saw some wild honey, and with his staff helped himself to some of it and ate it. And the news went round, and came by tale-bearer to Saul. Because a soldier said to Jonathan, your father said we were not to eat until the Philistines were routed. My father, said Jonathan, He's a troublemaker. Why, said Jonathan, even that lick of honey has given me new heart. And they could see that his eyes were shining. So Israel pursued the fleeing Philistines to the borders of their territory, Aijalon, the other side of the ridge, and plundering them. Desperately hungry, these poor men, they made a feast of the livestock they had captured. But Saul had gone all religious. He built an altar to the Lord, the first time he'd ever done that, and intended to follow the Philistines down to their own territory and destroy them. But of course, the priests said they would have to inquire of the Lord first. All right, said Saul, what did the Lord say? Not a word. The Lord had nothing to say to sick Saul, who had done more harm than good to Israel's cause that day. The Lord would not answer. The heavens were as brass. So, isn't this interesting? Saul blamed his men. God wouldn't speak. There was sin in the camp, but it couldn't be his. There's sin in the camp, he said. And so, by lot, they picked out Jonathan. That lick of honey, you remember. Oh, yes, Jonathan admitted eating a little honey contrary to his father's command. What about it? So it's you, Jonathan, said Saul, as if he had discovered the greatest sinner of the day, and not the human author of an almost single-handed rout of the Philistines. You shall die, Jonathan, said his raving father. Not on your life, said the men of Israel, not a hair of his head shall be touched. Why, it was he who gave us this marvelous victory. Collapse of Saul, do you think? Well, we don't know, but we feel like saying to someone, take him home, somebody, and put him to bed, and send for a psychiatrist. It's quite clear, you see, by the way, from the end of chapter 14, that over 40 years, or however many it was that Saul reigned, many things took place which are summarized here in very short compass. I think that there is very little doubt that the great surgence, if that's a word, the great surgence of bitter revolt against Israel, as described in these verses 47 and 48, was to some extent due to Saul being at odds with the Lord. Yet it's clear that Saul had many successes, of which there seemed to be no other note than here. What we know about his subsequent years is mostly in relation to his hostility against his successor, David. There's obviously something radically wrong with this man. Don't you begin to see it? And, of course, with the state of Israel under his reign. Of that we are sure. Indeed, we'll see the worst of that in the next 15th chapter. And so, meantime, we are left to speculate on a good deal of the course of the fevered career of this first king of Israel. A king there had to be, and was meant to be. Well, King Jesus is proof of that. But they sought a king for the wrong reason. to be like other folk, which was diametrically opposed to God's will for them. He wanted them to be distinct from the heathen, not like other folk. So everything was bound to go wrong. And perhaps the bitterest lesson we learn here tonight is of the spiritual and mental sickness of Saul against his own son Jonathan, who would have made a far better king and certainly a godlier king than his father. Indeed, as we know, David himself would almost have as soon, perhaps sooner, have had Jonathan as king than himself. Whereas Jonathan obviously wanted David to be king, as chapter 18, verses 1 to 4 makes plain. Let me read those verses. They're very beautiful. 1 Samuel 18, 1 to 4. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house. And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic and even his sword, his bow, and his belt. That wonderful? There was, you see, this very rare identity of character between David and Jonathan, so that being entirely like-minded, they stuck closer than brothers. And of course there'll be more of that in due course as we go on with this wonderful book. But I thought it might be just as well to say now, in view of the subject being in the air, and it will be again at the General Assembly, being in the air just now, that many, especially unhealthy-minded spirits, have charged these two men, David and Jonathan, with having an illicit sexual relationship. There is absolutely no scriptural ground for that in the world. Do you mean to say that there cannot be between those of the same sex, men or women, a quality of mutual love which is rare and fine and tender and strong and true, but which has absolutely nothing of a sordid nature in it at all? It's only dirty minds which project their own perverse thoughts onto innocent souls, and often make other people's lives miserable by their innuendos and false accusations. One of the things which has given me greater joy than I can express is the bonds of friendship which I have seen formed between many in the Lord, including many ministers in Scotland and beyond. And I'm sure the Lord is using these to encourage us all to be faithful and true to our common Lord and to each other. After all, the Lord's command is to love one another. And there is surely nothing unsavory about that. Nor need there be any limit to the tender bonds which bind us to one another. God can keep them pure. And he does. He does. Hallelujah. Amen.